Okay, and welcome to the third in our spring seminar series. We have today three speakers from the Medical Museum Trust Board, the trustees of the Medical Museum.
Yes.
Yep. The Medical Museum, which was it was established in 1980 by Dr. David Warnock. And the collection was of medical memorabilia, and you see some of it here, was described in 2021 as the largest of its type in New Zealand. Unfortunately, there was, I don't know, how many of you have been to the museum in the hospital? Okay, about a third of you. Okay, unfortunately, in May last year, they had to vacate their premises. So there are some display cabinets in the museum, but a lot of the other material is in storage. They, if any of you have any spare place for a museum in your garage or whatever, just let them know, because they are looking. And it's for those of you who've been, and from what you'll see today, I think you'll probably consider that it's well worthwhile seeing. Now, just to briefly mention your speakers, we have two, Mickey Tyler and Marilyn Linklater, both had careers as dental nurses, and they've seen a large number of changes in here, and you'll see some of the instruments later. John Sendell is a retired specialist anaesthetist, and he estimates he's administered over 40,000 anaesthetics. And obviously seen the evolution of anaesthesia, all the changes that have taken place. And in all these areas, there's been lots of changes. I should also perhaps mention the Palmerston valve. I don't know if John's going to say anything about that. Okay, so above and beyond that, I'll just leave it to our speakers to elucidate on the equipment here and the history of the museum, etc., etc. Okay?
Thank you, Stuart, for your welcome, and thank you for the opportunity for us to be able to tell you something about the past, the present, and the future of the Medical Museum. As Stuart said, it was established in 1980 by Dr. David Warnock, and it was initially called the Medical Museum with the Neil Little Collection, which we have up here. Now, Dr. Little was an ear, nose and throat surgeon, wasn't he? And David Warnock was asked if he would accommodate Dr. Little's collection as well. So that was how it started. And it wasn't until later that we renamed the museum, after all the work that Dr. Warnock had put into it, that we renamed it the David Warnock Medical Museum. David started the museum. He was a passionate collector of medical memorabilia, and he worked as a consultant at the hospital. And David was one of those people that could get anything from anyone up at the hospital. He seemed to be able to get a lot of what he asked for. But all they would give him initially was some space in the basement at the hospital. Well, that was fine for him, but of course the public had no access to it at all. So that was in 1980, and it wasn't until 2006 that he was actually given a vacant building, or a building that became vacant, over on campus, over on the Heritonga side of the hospital, for him to set up the museum there. And from there, he had great cooperation with staff from the hospital. They had builders at the hospital at that stage, and they built a pharmacy, which I think we'll see up here also. And we had a mock pharmacy there. And that man, every time you opened the door to go into the museum, it was like, what are you doing here? It was really very well done. But also he had the builders setting up a little mock theatre and everything, which John will tell you more about later. So 2006 it was when David moved the museum over there, and in 2007 it then became open to the public. Now there is a lot of history in that collection with the Medical Museum, and it became a place for the public to visit, listed by the City Council. And we were listed on History Week as a place to visit, but as well as that, we had a lot of groups from within Palmerston North and from away, and they would come to Palmerston for the day, go to the Wildlife Centre, come to the Medical Museum, have lunch, whatever. But we did, we had a lot of people coming and going, which will be missed, sadly, by a lot. 2012, unfortunately, David passed away, and I then inherited the title of curator of the museum. So I felt, right from when I first met David, I had a lot of collection of old dental equipment. Now, you'll all know what this is, an old dental drill. And I had the old drill, an old wooden chair, and quite a few other things. And I found David down in the basement of the hospital and said to him, would he be interested in having this old equipment? And he just looked at me and said, I'll have it and I'll have you too. So that was how I became involved with it, and I have been involved ever since. And I have thoroughly enjoyed it. Sad to see David pass away, but he had it all up and running and extremely well. It was going extremely well. The Medical Museum is administered by a charitable trust and chaired by Dr. John Burke, who's the geriatrician at the hospital. It's run by volunteers, gold coin donation, and it is an independent organisation until now, worked in cooperation with the hospital and the hospital staff. But we are no longer supported by the museum on hospital grounds. Tell you more about that later. However, the main aim of the museum is to preserve medical history for the public to visit. As I say, there is so much history there, and so many of the public who come have had some connection one way or another with the hospital. Throughout the museum, when we had it set up, we had sections of different aspects of medicine. And the hospital itself was built, I thought you might be interested in one or two of these little significant issues, items. The hospital was built in 1892 at a cost of £3,760. It had four wards and 25 patients. And the first matron in 1902 was Ellen Doherty. Now, Ellen Doherty was the first state registered nurse, not only in New Zealand but in the world, because the Nurses Union here lobbied for registration, and that was how that came about. But we have had quite a lot. Oh, there's a few more little snippets here. I thought the actual block that the council bought to build the hospital on was a 10-acre block in Ruahini Street, which is where it is now, and they bought that for £300. The first matron I've told you about, the opening day was the 27th of November, and the first horse-drawn ambulance was put into operation in 1901. So I thought that was very interesting. The first motorised ambulance was purchased in 1914. So those are just some interesting snippets about the hospital, and we'll go on further to tell you a little bit more. That's a lot to do with our past. John's going to tell us a lot about our present and then the future. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Thank you for giving us the pleasure to come and tell you about our museum. Despite the rain, I've got a lot of hay fever at the moment, so please excuse me if I start coughing and take the microphone off. I came to Palmerston North in 1983 as a called a senior registrar. I'd done my specialist training, but I hadn't done enough months and years to be registered as a specialist. So the dear hospital paid me as a cheap trainee, and the department worked me as a specialist expert. And in my first week, I actually got to work with David Warnock. And out of the hospital and out of theatre, he was the most wonderful gentleman you could ever hope to meet. But like most of the surgeons of that era, to put it politely, in the operating room, he was somewhat stern and austere. And the second patient I had to anaesthetise, in those days there would be two eye operations on a whole afternoon list, and it would be a 2-hour general anaesthetic. If any of you have had cataracts done recently, you know how simple it is with a little injections. Anybody had cataracts done? Yeah. And I suggested to David that I could do an injection in this patient's eye, and that would be much simpler than, you know, this patient with a bad heart and all the problems. And he stood up and he said, "We're never going to have an anaesthetist putting a needle anywhere near the eye." So when I actually got my specialist registration, and Brian Crichton said, "Which list do you want to do?" I said, "Any but the eye list." And I virtually didn't do any eye lists from that day onwards. But the following year, I went to Oxford and worked there for a year, which I'll tell you a little bit about. But then when I came back, I actually bought David's house in Margaret Street, which has got some interesting history. And from then on, we were the best of friends. And he was constantly shoulder-tapping me to come and help him with the museum. He knew a lot, obviously, about some of the antiquities and the eye equipment. And he knew very, very little about sort of the anaesthesia equipment or some of the general sort of surgical things. So we brought a few artefacts along here for you to see. And really what I want to sort of show to you is how much the technology has changed over 100 years, and even in my 40 years. I used to say to my trainees used to ask me, John, what monitors, what machines did you have for watching the patients when you were a trainee? And I would rudely, that and that. We would look at the colour of the patient's fingernails to see how well oxygenated they were. We would feel the pulse of the temporal artery and the head. And half of the time, that would be all the monitors that we had. And now when you go into the operating room, you can see it's like the cockpit of a 777, the electronic workstations and so many things. So that sort of technology has sort of changed a lot. And these are some pieces that we had. You'll see during the tea break, we've got some colour slides of the museum. You'll see the mock operating theatre that we had. And these are things that I have seen come in my time. The greatest invention in sliced bread, you've probably got your own blood pressure machines at home now. And the non-invasive, the automatic machines came in at about 1980. Prior to that, we'd be doing a hip replacement with this on the patient's arm, trying to listen with a stethoscope while the surgeon was banging away on the other end. 1990, pulse oximeters came in, and this was the first pulse oximeter that we had in the operating theatre and recovery rooms. If any of you have been around COVID recently, you've seen the modern ones that are just a little thing that puts on your finger, and you can have an app that does your blood pressure and your pulse rate and emails it to your doctor. There's been a huge change in my time. You'll see from these colour pictures that we had a number of group displays. So there was a surgical display, some medical equipment, some obstetric equipment, and of course Mickey will tell you all about the sort of the dental things. One of the big areas that we're really proud of is the military memorabilia that we have. Anybody driven down Martin Street in Terrace End recently? Do go and have a look. It's one of those streets that has the poppy on it, because it's named after A.A. Martin. Arthur Alexander Martin was the first full-time surgeon in Palmerston North and subsequently the medical superintendent. And so we had a large display of his memorabilia. Unfortunately, he went twice to the First World War, and on the second occasion he was he was a pioneer in resuscitative and early surgery, and getting patients operated on near to the scene, whereas in the past they would sit in a field ambulance or nearby and not be evacuated, and a lot of them died either of cholera or other diseases alongside their injuries. So he went to rescue another soldier from his unit and was hit by a shell on the way back and died from those injuries. And he wrote a book, A Surgeon in Khaki, which is now still regarded as one of the foremost classics on war surgery and medical resuscitation. You see down this far end here, this medical kit, this is one of a number that we have that's intact as it came to New Zealand on a ship in 1860. If you look at some of these, we had to empty some of these because health and safety these days, we can't have a lot of the nasty things around. But of course, in 1860, there were very few true medicines. There was probably morphine, atropine, and there's odd things like even strychnine was used as a medicine. So most of the things were either plant or extracts or tinctures. It's probably the best they had. We have another chest from the Māori Wars that the army surgeon had that he carried around with his horse to look after the soldiers. One of the other pictures you'll see we've got the iron lungs here, we've got the picture there. There have been a number of polio epidemics in New Zealand over the decades. And certainly my father and dear Uncle Peter can remember as a child their mates going off to hospital, and if they were lucky they came home with a gammy leg. One of them didn't come home. You know, polio was very infectious. It was relatively mild for most people. If they were lucky, it affected the spinal cord and paralysed their legs. And if you talk to some of the 90-year-olds around now, they remember their friends being in hospital for 3 months with their legs in plaster. A few people, there's a book we have in the museum written by June Oppie, Over My Dead Body, which is a description of her time in the iron lung and how not very pleasant it was. You can imagine being stuck in there with someone having to do all your body functions for you. The basis of the iron lung is its negative pressure ventilation. So it's closed around the neck, and a large pump cycles and sucks the air out of the box, which lifts the lungs up and allows some mild form of breathing. Whereas probably later in the Swiss pioneered the sort of early intensive care methods of ventilation, probably in the mid-60s, when they actually passed breathing tubes into the patients and then did the positive pressure from the outside, so it meant you could look after the rest of the patient much more easily than you would have done in an iron lung. This one's a prototype that was sort of made in Australia by the Bosch company. It wasn't used in Palmerston North. There's a bit of discussion of where it came from. One book says Martinborough. I had been told it came from Blenheim, but it certainly wasn't used in Palmerston North. There was one here. One of my side stories, I was very lucky in 1985, I went to work in Oxford. And that was really the foremost place for anaesthesia from the 40s onwards. It all came about thanks to the philanthropy of William Morris, who later became Lord Nuffield. His golfing partner was a certain Robert McIntosh, who the anaesthetist claimed was English. He was the foremost English anaesthetist. In fact, he was born in Timaru and christened Riwi Rafferty McIntosh. And he happened to go off to England, and he was over there doing his training when the Second World War broke out, and he ended up in the army. But he went back, and he met William Morris, and Morris was not a very healthy man. He was a heavy drinker and a heavy smoker, and he got osteomyelitis in his tibia, his lower part of his leg. in the surgeons, and the doctors told him, well, you're so crook, you'd die if you had an anaesthetic. So he told this story to McIntosh, and McIntosh said, I will give you an anaesthetic. And so he gave Morris an ether anaesthetic on the kitchen table, because it was quite common in those days. And he would have started that probably with one of these open Schimmelbusch type masks. He might have started it with some ethyl chloride, which is a highly volatile, fast-acting vapor, would have been sprayed onto the mask. And then he probably would have dropped some ether onto the mask. And the local GP drilled the hole in the osteomyelitis and drained it. And Morris did very, very well. He then decided that he wanted to give money to the Oxford University, and the university said, that's great, yes, we'll have personal chairs of medicine, surgery and obstetrics. And he said, no, you won't. You'll have medicine, surgery, obstetrics and anaesthesia. And they said, no, anaesthesia, anybody can give an anaesthetic, it's not a speciality. He said, well, it is now, and you will have my friend McIntosh as the first Nuffield professor of anaesthesia, or you won't have my money. So that's how he became the first professor of anaesthesia, basically in the Western world, Commonwealth, and English-speaking countries, I think is the polite way of putting it. There were a couple of Americans, Ralph Waters and others, but they were associate professors in a department of surgery. They were actually effectively half surgeons rather than, you know, it wasn't an academic post in anaesthesia. I was very lucky to meet McIntosh, and I sat next to his technician, Richard Salt, at a dinner. And this shows you how often in medicine and surgery how accidents can happen and things can evolve to be very, very useful. You might like to have a look at this later, but this is what's called a Boyle Davis gag. You wouldn't want to have this put in your mouth when you're awake, but when the surgeon took your tonsils out, they would have used a similar gag to this. So that it's put in the mouth and then the blade is retracted, so it holds the mouth open and the surgeon can see your tonsils at the side of the mouth. In 1946 at the Radcliffe Infirmary, McIntosh was giving an anaesthetic for an adult tonsillectomy, and the trainee surgeon had a too big a blade, and he put it in and cranked it back, and they connected the ether bubbled from a machine like, or a flow bottle like this, through the little tube down the end, and the patient breathes the ether to keep them asleep. But there was a beautiful view of the larynx, the voice box, and Richard Salt, his technician, said to him, you know, Richard, Robert, if you had an instrument like that, you could cannulate the trachea. Because I was saying about the iron lung, you know, it wasn't usual to put breathing tubes down the windpipe patients in that era. So Dickie Salt went away and he got the blade, put a wire down the tube, put a bulb on the end and a torch on the end of it. And that was how the first Macintosh laryngoscope came about. We've got some very early ones, but not, which I can't get one to work, but this is a more modern version, which you'll find in virtually every hospital department everywhere in the world, where breathing tubes are placed and the airways are managed. And so Richard Salt softened up the blade from the gag and bent it into a Z shape, so it's put into the mouth and lifts the tongue out of the way, and then you can see the voice box underneath and pass the breathing tube. These are all museum pieces now because disposable plastic technology and electronics have taken over. So all our trainees now will start off using a video laryngoscope, which is like this. It's got a little screen on the end, the fibre optic there, so you can actually see round the corner with that. So it's really good for difficult airways, pregnant women where you can't get the, you know, because their chest's up here, or people with spinal injuries, or elderly people with stiff necks. You cannot crank their neck up and see the voice box. So with the video, you're looking round the corner. So that, we've got whole boxes and boxes of these different types of, for looking down. Most anaesthetists are taught how to use one of these. We've got a pile of these in the museum. That's a bronchoscope, so that will fit on the laryngoscope handle. So it puts a light down there, so you can actually look down the windpipe and pull out the peanut or the piece of apple or polystyrene B that the child's inhaled before the surgeon's washed his hands. Something I threw into the museum recently This is a rather innocent looking piece of stainless steel, but actually very, very useful every day for anaesthetists. It was designed by an Indian lady called Patel, who's an expert on teaching the management of difficult airways, and I was fortunate. She came to Auckland once and I attended her course, and she gave us one of these. So when you go in and the anaesthetist do his or her assessment, you want to do some simple measurements from underneath your chin to the top of your voice box, and that in a female should be 6 centimetres or 6.5 centimetres in an adult male. So it's one of the things that you can tell from the end of the room whether somebody's, you know, some gentleman you can't see, but that somebody's going to have a difficult airway. But again, with the video technology now, that's a museum piece. So going through some of the technology that we have, certainly anaesthesia's changed. This is long before my time. This is in 1928, a very early Boyle's machine. Boyle was a London anaesthetist who was probably one of the earlier competitors to Macintosh. And these are just simple ether or trilene and a water bath, so that the oxygen would be bubbled through and would come out of a tube that would be applied to some sort of airway in the patient. Macintosh founded a couple of companies in Oxford that were, for many years, were the major producers of anaesthesia equipment. But he was very innovative. And this little vaporizer here was the first temperature control. Because, you know, if you put ether in a glass thing like that, as it vaporizes, the latent heat of vaporization takes all the water vapor from the atmosphere and freezes on the outside, and so that it no longer vaporizes. So this has got a huge, great, it's quite heavy, it's got a huge, great copper heat sink in the bottom. In Macintosh in the early 40s, I think it was 1943, he wanted to devise a vaporizer or an anaesthesia machine that could be taken to a war zone or up Everest or to base camp. And that's basically what he wanted. He wanted something like this that could go in your rucksack. And it's a draw-over vaporizer. So as the patient breathes, their breath draws over the vaporizer. And it's calibrated, which was, the first really calibrated. Because the problem with anything like this or doing open, you never know how much vapor you're giving. I was horrified last year. My sister, doing some genealogy, discovered our paternal grandfather died of chloroform shock. And, you know, chloroform would have been administered, just dropped from a bottle like that, probably by the house surgeon or the student nurse. And they just kept on giving it until the patient stopped moving or the surgeon told them the patient had died. And the nice handwriting underneath of Granddad's death certificate says, ruptured gallbladder septicemia. So while the chloroform shock might have been a precipitating factor, basically what happened is that they gave too much, and the blood pressure and the heart function would have gone down. And chloroform also causes very, very slow heart rates. So it would have been, it was a shock effect on the chloroform that finished him off when he was really sick. So having, knowing what concentration you're giving and having accurately maintained was sort of quite useful for that sort of generation. If any of you looked at British engineering and old motorbikes or old cars, you know, it can be pretty crude sometimes. And often a lot of the parts, you can still get them readily because they're just general pieces of engineering. This is a golden vaporizer, which a dental anaesthetist would have taken in his pocket or her pocket to the dentist surgery for the demand nitrous oxide oxygen machines. Again, you know, as the patient breathed, it would open the valve and they'd get some nitrous oxide and oxygen. The dentist would put the mask on your face with 100% oxygen until you went blue, and then you'd start pulling your teeth out. But this golden vaporizer was designed to go on the nitrous oxide oxygen demand, so you could use a small amount of halothane, and it generally only used by specialist anaesthetists. And back in the 60s, it was sort of put about that it was safer for the dentist to give you an anaesthetic than the anaesthetist. But the reality was is that it was generally the dentist was doing them on the fit, athletic 20-year-old students for their wisdom teeth. and the anaesthetist was coming along with the older, not so well patients. But that the piece of glass underneath there, which you filled with halothane, and you drew all the patient's breath over it, is a float bar of a Massey Ferguson tractor. So it was just a cheap bit of readily available. It was probably, knowing the British factories, there was probably thousands of them sitting around that never got used. So they used it to make a vaporizer. Technology sort of moved on during my time. These are also flow compensated. So this is a more accurate vaporizer from early 80s to early 90s, mid 90s. And again, very, very accurately measured concentrations. But again, anaesthesia in those days for me was you gave something and then looked at the effect of it and then modified what you were doing, looking at the effects. Nowadays, you have one of these cartridge vaporizers, which is a bit like the fuel injector in your car, and using the monitor that monitors the concentration of the vapor feeds back to this. So as the patient is breathing, it's actually sort of the vapor building up in the breathing circuit. This, like your fuel injector in your car, controls the concentration at a constant level. I've probably seen some huge changes in surgical techniques in my time. We were given some old instruments that were probably at least 1950s. Because I showed them to a young 60-year-old surgeon and he had no idea what these things were. Surgery in those days was pretty big and gross. I'm guessing that's some sort of bone holder, so if you had got some medium-sized fractured bones, this would be holding them together so they could wire them or plate them. We had a nice orthopedic display which had a number of prostheses and things. This is a very early femoral hip prosthesis, you know, a larger ball that would replace, if you'd fractured your hip high up, what we call a subcapital fracture, where it breaks just underneath and you lose the blood supply to the head, then they take the head of the femur off and replace it with one of these, and it fits in your natural bony acetabulum, as opposed to the Chandley ones. John Chandley in 1961 was a pioneer in England, and up until the 1980s, all that, New Zealand orthopaedic surgeons would go to Manchester and learn how to do hip replacements by Chandley. He was one of the first surgeons that really realised they had to talk to engineers and get engineers to help them design these things, because there's not only the simple mechanics, but the geometry and the loading of them is quite critical. So he quickly worked out there's no good replicating the natural bony hip to that sort of size. So the original Chandley prostheses were only like 12, 15 millimetres. They were quite small. But they had a lot of problems with the plastics and things that they were working inside. Knee replacements are a relatively new phenomenon, but this is an older type of prosthesis. That's a femoral prosthesis that will go in the knee. So we had a big selection of those. We collected a lot of things in our big storage unit and we really know where half of them came from, but when we were sorting them out, packing up to come out, I boxed up a lot of orthopaedic things and they'd gone to their department and they're using them for teaching. Because one of the things I found is if the trainees learn why things were made the way they were 40, 50, 70 years ago, then they learn how you can use the tools that we have today, why they were designed to be like that. Amongst this stuff, actually, I took some photos down to Invercargill. I was doing a locum there last year and showed them to an orthopaedic surgeon who collects old orthopaedic equipment. His eyes lit up and he said, that's a very early 1960s Chandley revision set. There's virtually none, you wouldn't find one of those anywhere else in the world. So there in our junkyard in Palmerston North was this big set of instruments that would have been used for doing the second time. So when they have to take the cement out of the femur and out of your acetabulum, there's a whole lot of big, grindy, mincy machines. And there was we've got the complete kit, which no one else in New Zealand has seen in recent years, which is quite nice. Mickey mentioned the pharmacy, and there's a huge sort of collection of various artifacts of drug bottles, pharmacy jars, and lots of other little bits and pieces. Two perhaps of our most valuable possessions from 17th century Chinese apothecary jars of David Warnock. It was one of his passions. He loved collecting things that were bizarre and unusual. So we've got two of these beautiful, big, colourful apothecary jars. I hesitate to put a value on them, but they're certainly probably amongst the most valuable things we have. Also something you probably, not even your grandparents would have seen, is a Chinese leech jar. So they kept leeches in these sort of China jars, and they would take them out and put them on swollen fingers and joints and things. In the main room of the museum, we had a very large nursing exhibition. We've got a lovely collection of nursing uniforms through various decades, quite different to the sort of functional uniforms that the nurses will be wearing in this day and age. One of the nice, humorous things that Mickey was telling me about the other day is it's a nursing trolley. So if those of us that were born in the sort of in the 50s, you know, the baby, mum would have been in hospital for 3 weeks. They would have taken the baby to mum, feed the baby into the nursery, and this nursing trolley would have had 8 babies, 4 in the top row and 4 in the bottom row. And you can easily understand how, you know, hopefully they didn't get mixed up.
The lady who gave us that said her mother worked with one in a hospital where they had one, 6 on top and 6 on the bottom, and she said, rumour had it that the babies got mixed up. She said, they did.
Oh.
I've got a little bit out of order with my spiel I was writing, but I've written down. So, yeah, the iron lungs we achieve. Yeah, I think in many ways, you guys, if you think and you're philosophical, I think we're perhaps on this earth, we're perhaps one of the luckiest generations of all time. And I think, you know, certainly in my medical career, you know, how technology has come on, and you know, I've been very lucky to have seen a lot of developments, but not had to deal with, put it polite, management and internal politics so much until recent years. And I guess that's probably the same in many jobs. I'm a Rotarian, so I've been very interested in the polio. And if there's any other Rotarians here, you'll know, excuse me, that Rotary International and Bill Gates have had a big campaign to eradicate polio in the world. During my 40 years, I've seen not active polio, but I've seen, you know, post-polio patients with leg problems. It's a particular interest to anaesthetists because where the nerve cells are damaged in the spinal cord are hypersensitive to some of the muscle relaxants and drugs that we might use, and they're more sensitive to the respiratory depressing effects of morphine and those sort of drugs. When I worked in Oxford, they still had an old-fashioned intensive care unit and a neurosurgical unit at the Radcliffe Infirmary. And there were two patients that came in. One lady came in alternate nights, and another man that came in every single night and spent his nights in the iron lung because he would, you know, his breathing at night when he laid down was inadequate. So he was, and that was, you know, it was 1985, and there were still people that were affected by the polio. As Mickey said, one of the things that David set up in the museum area, in what was probably the nursing area of the old mental health unit, was a mock operating theatre, and there was an orthopaedic operating table from the 1950s, and we had a dummy surgeon. It was very good because he didn't speak and tell us what to do. And we had a whole collection of some of it, and I started putting in some of the anaesthesia gear, and... Also, the other thing that's changed quite dramatically in terms of technology, if you've been into an operating theatre and had an operation under a local or a regional anaesthetic, you will have heard the humming of the cautery, the diatherming machines. Well, they're basically just a radio frequency generator that puts that sort of high frequency current down a little wire and a little electrode, which they use for sealing. Or with different other frequencies, they can change the frequency and actually use it for bloodless cutting. So it's a tool that's used in many forms of surgery routinely now. And we had a 1940s diathermy machine in our mock operating theatre. My uncles was an electrical engineer who trained in Birmingham, and in Birmingham they developed the valves for some of the first radar machines that the Air Force were using. And he told me the funny story that they actually got diathermy machines like this, and they took them down to the south coast and connected them up to wireless aerials so they would broadcast this random scamming signal, because the Germans had this very sophisticated thing called Knickerbein, which basically gave them radio beacons that they could direct and navigate from, so that the Germans were dropping their bombs over the sand hills rather than the towns and the cities. We had a 2020 diathermy machine, which was a little thing that was like this size in comparison, and you know, probably 300 times more powerful.
That's probably most of what I can tell you about what we've had in medicine, surgery, and anaesthesia. And I'm more than happy to answer any sort of questions, you know, with the tea time. Thank you.
Okay, we're not finishing yet, because there's a dental nursing murder house discussion.
Thank you. Who likes going to the dental? Who likes going to the dental clinic? For those of you who were young primary age children in New Zealand, you will all know what this is.
Murder house.
We had a little section of the school dental service up in the museum, and every group that came past, we got oohs and ahs as they went past this. Now I'll tell you why they got oohs and ahs. Talking of anaesthesia, I've worked in the dental service for close to 50 years, which is a long time, so I have seen enormous changes. And people just did not realise how bad it was with this. It wasn't so much the pain of the drill as the vibration. Slowly, we peddled away on this all day, like some of you would have had yours or your mother's old treadle sewing machine. It was hard work. We stood to operate, we used this, and we were not allowed to use local anaesthetic for conservative work. Later on, we were only allowed to use it for extractions. However, look, the school dental service was another one of our firsts in New Zealand. It was the first primary age school dental service in the world. And a lot of other countries came and observed. We had a mezzanine floor with a little veranda that sat out over our big surgery in Wellington. And we would look up there and see dignitaries from other countries up there. And several countries patterned their services on ours. The school dental service here was started in the 1920s, and it was started purely because the dentists could not cope with the work that was needed. The children in New Zealand had extremely poor teeth, and the dentists just could not cope. And although they were a little bit not sure about having these auxiliary people starting to work on the children's teeth, they realised just how much value we were. But that was how it happened. And the children's teeth in New Zealand were some of the worst in the world at that age. However, we had no fluoride naturally found in our soil or in our structure of the country here, whereas some countries did. However, we had fluoride introduced here in the 60s over in the Hastings area. It was introduced on a trial, and very soon started to show very positive effects. I know a lot of people are still anti-fluoride, but the fluoride, even in the toothpaste, has made huge, huge differences to the state of children's teeth. We're now fighting the sugar drinks, of course. So the treatment came down when I was working. We used to see the children initially. We used to see the children every 6 months, twice a year. Then it got, with the advent of fluoride, it got to seeing them annually, once a year. And now it's, they're fighting, because the numbers were reduced of dental nurses, etc., etc., but they're now fighting against the sugar, the effects from sugar drinks, and the long lists of little children who are on hospital waiting lists to have general anaesthetics, in other words, to have all their teeth removed. These are the first teeth, baby teeth, of course, not the permanent teeth. However, I have to say that children accepted the dental treatment that we gave them incredibly well, and I'm going to tell you a story. It was pretty tough at times. I remember having to take out a little baby molar. Now, when I say a little baby molar, they were actually quite big and they were fairly firmly seated in a child's jaw. And this little boy, without only infiltration anaesthetic, not general anaesthetic, this little boy was absolutely wonderful. He was a five-year-old. And when I'd finished, I couldn't help it. I just put my arm around him, which I wouldn't be allowed to do now. But I said, "You were wonderful. I could have you for my little boy." Well, I got to work the next morning and he was sitting on the step of the dental clinic with his suitcase and his teddy bear. And he said, "Mum said you can have me." So, you know, and had its happy times as well, or some funny times anyway. But dentistry, I saw dentistry come a long, long way. I worked right through from the treadle drill to high-speed drill. Now, cutting or repairing a tooth with a high-speed drill was like drilling through butter compared to the drilling through a tooth. We did, on those treadle drills, it was nothing in those days to start at one side of the mouth and do fillings all the way around to the other side. However, things have changed, and a lot of people now in their 80s, 90s, and now sometimes 100, are living with their own teeth. Now, that tells us a lot, and we've come a long, long way. I had a grandson who'd been working over off the coast of Norway on one of the oil rigs over there. He had a Norwegian girlfriend whom he brought home one Christmas, and she told me that in Norway, I'm going back about 20 years now, but in Norway they all got a set of dentures on their 21st birthday. Now, how bad is that? Yes, it's interesting. However, we now think, I don't think anyone really likes going to the dentist, but it's certainly, prevention is better than cure, and it's not nearly so hard now to maintain good teeth. We also have another first in New Zealand, in fact in Palmerston North. We were the first school dental service, which became, that was then, now it's run by, it was a national service, it's now run individually by the hospital services, but we were the first in New Zealand to take or set up an adolescent mobile clinic to go into the high schools, and that is still operating here. The good part about that was that although dental care is free until 18, a lot of children will not take up the offer after they leave school, where it's compulsory at the primary schools, and they're not going to get up and go into town. But in the high schools, if they saw their mate coming in, oh, it was okay, he came back all right, so all right, I'll go and let them have a look at my teeth. So it does treat a lot of children who would never otherwise continue, and save the government huge costs also. And people, once they get to over age 18, having really bad decay, bad teeth, a lot of work needed, and they haven't got the money to pay for it. So, but anyway, that one little thing I will just tell you, which I think is of interest, rather funny. The training school in Wellington, where I trained, is long gone. All the training now is done down in Otago. But a developer bought that building and made it into apartments and called it Mercury Apartments. Now, we worked with Mercury. We mixed Mercury and silver alloy together. We squeezed out the mercury onto the floor like this, and then we used the filling and put it into the teeth. The linos in all the dental clinics, when they were replaced, had a sea of mercury under them. However, there was a great hue and cry by everyone in Wellington about it being called Mercury Apartments, so they had to rename it to, I can't remember, but it's another name now. They were not allowed to call it Mercury Apartments. However, we also had little mercury pellets for the baby teeth, or the first teeth, that we used to heat over a Bunsen burner until the mercury rose, and we would just be breathing in a bit, and I still just know who I am. Thank you. One more, Stuart. This is just a little of the past, the present, and now where to from here for us. The Palmerston North will no longer support the museum on the hospital grounds. To keep the collection intact, we must find a suitable, affordable and sustainable location in order to do this. Currently, we have, as John has said, display cabinets in the hospital, but the majority of our collection is in storage. We plan to have some public displays from time to time and pop-ups when and where possible. Our main concern at this stage is affordability for the long-term storage. However, we're not going to give up. Thank you.